So, we are on week two of Jewish love. Last time round, we talked about the origin of love in the Torah. We talked about the creation of Adam and Eve, the two accounts of creation. In one account, the first account, we are much more associated with the rest of the creations, the plants, the birds, the fish, the animals. And there, our role in seeking a mate is much more about pru urvu, bearing fruit and multiplying. And the focus is really procreation. Whereas in the second chapter, it's more about this ezer kenegdo, the idea of finding an appropriate helpmate. It is after God has already told human beings, you are like the rest of my creations, because I address you directly, I even give you instructions, in which you're supposed to overcome your instincts and instead act in a way that is ethical and appropriate, that fits some kind of set of values. And there, the idea of having a mate is much more about moral development, ethical development, and growth. So those are the two aspects that we identified. And then we talked about the issue of love, of ahava, and whether there's any such concept as pure love. I noted that the word for love in Hebrew, ahava, is not only used regarding human beings in a relationship, but it's also about human beings in God. And as somebody emailed me during the week, it's also a term that we use for various human relationships. It's used for parents and children. It's used for all sorts of relationships, and it's beyond the romance of a pair of spouses. But we noted that the idea of pure love is not a new invention, even though various historians want to date it to the 11th century. We have the idea found in Jewish texts. We noted the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, going back a couple of thousand years, that talks about love that is not dependent on any particular external thing. We noted that in Aristotle as well. And that's what we're up to now, is just a last thought on pure love before we get to dating and some of the issues in dating, and then move on from that into marriage. So we're flowing from last week. I did carry over the source that we didn't do last week in the sheets that are here for this week. I generally try to do that. So one last note on the pure love discussion is that love is certainly there, as we said last week, and it's a desirable ideal, which we hope will endure in the relationship. But what it's not, I think the bill, no, it's okay. But what it's not is it's not part of those first two chapters of Bereshit, of Genesis. And in general in Judaism, marriage is seen not as a product of love, but as a fulfillment of these material spiritual needs that people have. And in truth, love is seen to usually, although there are exceptions, but generally, love is seen to develop between people who share experiences and come to know each other, and even to give to each other. That's usually the way that that love develops. It's something that's seen as a product of experiences as opposed to a generator of relationships. And here was something I found that was just fascinating. If you take a look on your sheet, at the first source from this week's sheets, from Aristotle, in the Nicomachean Ethics, he says the following: benefactors are thought to love those they have benefited more than those who have been well treated love those that have treated them well. Right? To put it into a parent-child context, parents love their children more than children love their parents. And at first, when people first think about this, they tend to be taken aback. Because after all, if love is to be seen as involving some level of gratitude, then you would say, well, the children owe the parents for their lives, and therefore the children should have the greater love for the parent, and isn't this unjust? However, what Aristotle is noting here is that that's not, love isn't gratitude. The two are not the same. And in fact, what we see is that you love someone more when you have helped them, as opposed to when you have received something from them. I always thought of this in a way that might be thought of a little maybe as cynical, although it wasn't intentionally so, and that it had to do with cognitive dissonance, right? As a psychological concept, cognitive dissonance, it means that we bring our thoughts into line with what we are doing. So in other words, if I am doing something and I don't really know why, I will subconsciously try to find redeeming value in it in order to feel better about what I'm doing. And it has all sorts of ramifications in human existence, but I wondered if I am putting so much effort into my child, so then I'm going to subconsciously look for reasons to do so and develop the thought process that will justify all that I'm doing rather than live my life resenting it. But what Aristotle notes here, take a look, is something deeper. He says we're after the ellipsis in source number one. This is what happens with craftsmen too. Every man loves his own handiwork better than he would be loved by it if it came alive. And this happens perhaps most of all with poets, for they have an excessive love for their own poems, doting on them as if they were their children. This is what the position of benefactors is like. For that which they have treated well is their handiwork, and therefore they love this more than the handiwork does its maker. The cause of this is that existence is to all men a thing to be chosen and loved. We think it's good to exist. There's a classic debate in the Talmud. Is it better for human beings to have been born or better for had we not been born? And the conclusion, of course, is it doesn't matter. You're here. Deal with it. But we generally say, says Aristotle, that existence is something that is good. Given the choice, we would like to exist, and if someone would not like to exist, we consider that to be unhealthy. Leave aside all discussion about physician-assisted death, and that's its own discussion. But he says, existence is to all men a thing to be chosen and loved, and that we exist by virtue of activity, i.e. by living and acting, and that the handiwork is, in a sense, the producer in activity. In other words, if I create a poem, the poem is a part of me. And even after I cease to exist, the poem will be me in this world. And not just the poem, but anything that you help to create has an element of you in it, he writes. And therefore, he loves his handiwork, therefore, because he loves existence. That's the way that Aristotle looks at it. So it's a very interesting idea. And what I found in it that was remarkable was not the existence of the idea. Because I've been hearing for a very long time about this idea. But I never knew that it was in Aristotle. The source that I had come across is a much, much more recent source. It's source number two. Rabbi Elio Dessler was in the yeshiva in Gateshead, England during World War II. And he wrote a work called Mechtav Me Eliyahu, literally a letter from Eliyahu, in which he posited the following. We are accustomed to think of giving as a product of love, for a person benefits the one he loves. But a second thought is that a person loves the fruit of his labor, feeling that it is part of his essence. Whether a child he has birthed or nursed, or an animal he has raised, or a sprout he has planted, or even in the silent realm, meaning the realm of things that don't speak, like a house he has built. He sticks to his handiwork with love, for he sees himself therein. It's the same idea. And it's very interesting because Rabbi Dessler has other writings that actually are similar to writings of other figures, more recent figures. I think Andrew Carnegie, Benjamin Franklin. There are all sorts of other ideas that you find in his writing as well. And I wonder if he didn't pull this Aristotelian idea from the ethics that we saw in number one. But in any case, that is an idea that's much more consistent in Judaism, and this takes me back to the point that somebody made last week. I don't remember if it was Jan who made this point. It might have been. Somebody was at this end of the table. No, it wasn't Jan. It was someone over there. They said that, sorry. The word in Hebrew is ahava. So Rabbi Dessler makes the point that the middle of that word, the middle two letters, are hav, hey, bet, which means to give. So your four-letter word in Hebrew for love, aleph, hey, bet, hey, the middle of it is hey bet, meaning to give. Love is rooted in not receiving, but actually in giving, which I think is a very nice idea. And I think that this is consistent with the position that we had in the opening source last week from Rebbetzin Ella Soloveitchik, when the statement was made that she doesn't want, she's not pursuing a marriage for honor, she's not pursuing wealth. What she wants is something that will be a covenant of love. Not that it starts out as a love at first sight thing. It's an arranged, setup. It's not that they saw each other on the subway and said, hey, let's go out. We want to meet each other. But rather something that develops into love. So that's the way that I understand it. There's more to be said about all of this, but we have to move into dating, because if we spend our entire life on love, then we'll be single forever. So let's talk dating. So once you start talking about dating, I think that there's an automatic question that comes up in people's minds, which is, what dating? What do you mean Judaism and dating? Wasn't it always arranged marriages? So in our experience in Europe, it is true that couples were set up by agreement of their parents. And when I say Europe, what I mean essentially is, call it the last 1,000 years of Jewish history up until the modern age. That's what you're talking about. And there were various reasons to do that. One reason to do it, parental desire to make sure that their children would have a good match. Keep in mind, people were getting married at a very young age. Even today, people think someone is young. Too young to get married if they're 21, 22. They say, what do you know? How can you decide already? People then were getting married 13, 14, 15. And so the parents are not going to leave it to them to figure out who they want to marry. The parents would decide for them, this is who's good for you, and then and then set them up. As we'll see, not that they would be married without having the opportunity to meet the other and so on, but that you were meeting the one who you were told you were meeting, and it wasn't like you went out for a year and decided, yeah, this is the one for me. That was one reason, was to make sure the children would choose a good match. A second reason was financial, meaning that marriage came with, still does come with, but came with it in those days, financial payments. Very serious financial payments. Both sides were responsible to set them up very well. And and because of that, when families knew that they had the money to do it, they would make an arrangement. When families felt like they needed money, they would go pursue an arrangement which they felt would meet those ends. And it's depressing to think about, but it's reality. They were looking for that which would set up the family in its best possible position financially. And so that's a second issue which we're going to come back to. The third of the three reasons was a general mistrust of mingling between genders. We have very serious prohibitions in the Torah against sexual immorality. There are grave concerns for what's going to happen in the event that there's mingling between people outside of marriage. We'll talk about that more when we get to the marriage topic. But as a result, they didn't want the kids going out and meeting people of the opposite gender. They were very afraid of where that could lead. What it could lead to is contemporary morality. But that's what they were afraid of. You know what I saw that absolutely blew my mind? These things don't generally blow my mind. I'm generally not going to admit that I'm shocked by anything. I grew up in New York. I went to school in Manhattan. You can't shock me. But I have to tell you, this was outright. I read it and I was like, that's crazy, and they're right. It was an advice column for teens on a website. Somebody forwarded me the link. It was an advice column. The teen wanted to know, without getting into all the gory details, the teen wanted to know, she's part of a chat group online, and they're all sharing pictures of themselves, and she wants to share pictures of herself, but she's worried because she doesn't know what's going to happen. She has great aspirations for her career, and what could happen if somebody divulges it? And you know what the columnist wrote back? I was stunned. The columnist wrote back saying, if you're underage, then you shouldn't be sharing this, because why should somebody go to jail, because of something that you share? That's an interesting moral argument. But then the columnist says, But you should realize that in just a few years, most people within society will have done that, will have shared that about themselves, and the people who are weird and unusual will be the people who haven't done so. And at that point, it won't be such an issue. Seriously? And then I started to do the math and realize that they're not... The person who's writing this column, I think, is out of her mind or his mind for writing it. But the truth of the matter is that from a factual perspective, you know, they may well be correct. I'm a dinosaur. Yeah, I know. I'm in good company. But that's what they're afraid of. I mean, they didn't have cell phones, so they didn't have the ability to do that, per se. But they said, you know what, let's arrange the marriages rather than have them all get together. We don't trust what's going to happen when they mingle. And that's the origin of the practice, those three factors. So it may have been arranged, and not only may it have been an arranged marriage, but it may have been arranged when they were minors. Not necessarily to marry as minors, that was generally avoided, but for them to arrange it for minors that they would marry in adulthood. And this was a concession, as I said before, to reality, mostly to financial reality. Take a look, please, at source number 3, though. I wanted you to see a couple of interesting things. This source goes back to the Talmud itself. So, you're going back now a couple of thousand years before our foray into Europe. There were no Jews in Poland at this point in our history. Number 3. A man may not betroth a woman without seeing her. Good advice. Lest he then find something unseemly in her and she might become disgraced to him. You don't want a situation in which the marriage is arranged, and then afterwards, when they get married, he sees her and realizes that he's not attracted to her, and she might become disgraced to him. And after all, the Torah says, love your neighbor as yourself. So in this case, your neighbor is your spouse, and the concern is that he won't love her. So I read that source, and my first thought is, okay, we're concerned there's a problem with the animal side of him. We're concerned that he's not going to be attracted to her, and now you have an issue. Why isn't it concerned about her seeing him? Right? The concern is specifically him seeing her. Why are they not concerned about her seeing him? Lest you jump to the standard 20th, 21st century answer of, well, they viewed women as chattel and therefore it didn't matter and so forth. No. The answer is borne out by medical research. I brought you links in sources 4 and 5. I didn't bring it on the sheet because I had other things I wanted on the sheet, but I gave you the links. There is study after study after study that has been done that says that, quite frankly, men are far more affected by the visual than women are. Whether it's true universally or not is not the point of the studies. Nothing is true universally. But as a broad statement, they discover repeatedly that men respond much more to the visual, and that it presumably is what they're concerned with. That's why the emphasis is specifically make sure that he sees her beforehand. But this is an arranged marriage. I talked about arranged marriages for 1,000 years in Europe. We're now seeing arranged marriages going back to then and just saying, okay, but make sure that they get a chance to see each other so that they sign off on it. But again, this wasn't considered to be desirable. Take a look at source number 6, where you see the comment dating back 800 years ago, 900 years ago in Europe. Comment on that passage in the Talmud. Now, when we betroth our daughters, even minors, it is because each day the exile becomes harsher for us, and if a man currently has the ability to give his daughter a dowry, perhaps he will not have this ability later, and she will sit unable to wed forever. The fear is, you have the financial means now, make the arrangement now, make the payment now, rather than risk what's going to happen in the event that you wait. Keep in mind, when is this written in Jewish history? I told you it's 12th to 13th century, Western Europe. What's going on at that moment? The Crusades, right? That's the period of the Crusades. And the fear is, you don't know. You think you have something today. Tomorrow, marauders come through on their way to fight their war in Jerusalem, and you have nothing. So that's the impetus. That's what I mentioned before about this financial arrangement. But more than that, the idea of an arranged marriage clearly was not universal and is not the oldest practice. You ever hear of Sadie Hawkins Day?
Yeah.
What's Sadie Hawkins Day?
Girl picks the guy.
Take a look, please, at source number 7. Source number 7 is a Mishnah at the end of the volume of Talmud called Ta'anit, describing a practice which goes back to the Second Temple period. It's talking about the Jewish calendar. It's right after. What is a Ta'anit? Anybody know? What does the word Ta'anit mean? A fast day, correct. So right after talking about the terrible days on the Jewish calendar, when bad things happen, the temple was destroyed and so on, right after that it says, let's end on a happy note and talk about two great days on the Jewish calendar. And one of them is Yom Kippur, which is considered to be a very happy day. It's a day of atonement. Yes, it's true that it's a solemn day, but it's happy. Yom Kippur is not a day for sadness. People should not be sad on Yom Kippur. Nonetheless, people do feel sad because they're not eating, but that's the way it goes. But Yom Kippur is considered to be a happy day, and then the other one is the 15th day of the month of Av. What in the world is the 15th day of the month of Av? So the Talmud describes all sorts of great events that happened historically on the 15th day of the month of Av. This comes out in the summertime. Kids in school generally don't learn about it, which is too bad. But take a look at source number 7, where we find out what they would do to celebrate on the 15th day of the month of Av. From this text, it sounds like it's Yom Kippur as well, but I think it was just the 15th day of Av. Maimonides commenting on this source in number 7, I think, indicates that. It says, there were no days as great for Israel as the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. For then the girls of Jerusalem would go out in white clothing, which was borrowed, so as not to embarrass those who didn't have. And they would dance in the vineyards. And what would they say? Young man, raise your eyes and see what you are choosing. Do not look for beauty, turn your eyes to family. And it goes on how each group of women will trumpet whatever they believe their assets are. If they believe that they're beautiful, they'll talk about beauty. If they believe they have family, wealth, then they'll say wealth, whatever it is. But each one will say, you know, look at me, essentially. It's not Sadie Hawkins Day in the sense that they're not going out and selecting males. However, this is not an arranged marriage. This is, they go out to the vineyards and they go dancing, and the guys walk up to them and say, hey, you seem like a nice person, and that's the way that they start dating. It's not it's not exactly the conventional idea of the arranged marriage environment. Clear so far? I'm going a little quickly, but there's a lot to cover, and we haven't even gotten into marriage, which is a real topic this week. So that's in terms of the arranged marriages. They absolutely did go on in our history. There are still communities that do it today that will have arranged marriages. There was always the insistence on some level of experience of each other in advance. You see the Talmud's line about the man seeing the woman, the concern for his obsession with the visual. And we also see that arranging marriages wasn't always the case. You have this Mishnah in Ta'anit describing a very different sort of practice.
Does the girl ever have the option of saying no?
Yes, the girl always has the option of saying no. There is absolutely no way within Torah for a woman or a man to get married against their will. That doesn't happen. So the other question, though, is funny. Actually, talking about marriage against one's will, what about bashert? Right, this Yiddish term that means it's all arranged. It's all set, which is not just somebody's made up concept. Take a look at source number 8. The Talmud has the statement, going back to the sage Rav, who lived in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. Rav Yehuda said, citing Rav, 40 days before a child is formed, a voice calls out, meaning a voice from heaven. In the Hebrew, the term is a bat kol. It means a small voice. And it says, the daughter of so-and-so is for so-and-so. The house of so-and-so is for so-and-so. The field of so-and-so is for so-and-so. It is all preordained. It's all set. The Talmud has a discussion about this and decides this is only about the first spouse, not necessarily remarriage. Remarriage, then it's all based on what you deserve. The first spouse is based on this, the second spouse is what you deserve. That's the Talmud statement, don't shoot me. So from this, it sounds like you're just, you know, predetermined. You're going to end up with somebody, and that's all there is to it. That's what it sounds like. Not only that, take a look at source number 9. A passage from the Talmud from a little bit later in our history. This is 5th century now. Rava, one of the sages, heard someone praying that he should get a certain woman for his wife. He wants whoever it is he's fallen in love with, and he's decided he wants to marry her, and he's praying, and apparently praying a little too loudly, that he should succeed in marrying her. Rava says to him, don't pray for this. If she's right for you, then she won't leave you. She won't get away. And otherwise, meaning if she's not the one for you, then you deny God. Because here you are praying to God, and she's not going to end up marrying you, and you're going to say, well, God didn't come through. So don't do it. It's all preordained. You shouldn't be praying for this. As a matter of fact, there's another Talmudic passage, which I see I did not bring on here, but you may have heard quoted, which says that marriages are as difficult for God to arrange as the splitting of the sea. Now, if you believe that God is all-powerful, then neither of them is difficult. But the point is that it's as miraculous as that. That people actually get together is nothing short of miraculous.
That's true. Going back on that.
Yes.
If it has been declared from heaven.
Yes.
Why is divorce?
Yeah. So that's the thing. This idea is beautiful until you think about it. You
well,
know? Yeah. Well, that's a real question. But before we get to the problems, let's first ask, what's the logic behind this? You will not find a biblical verse which describes God sitting down and arranging marriages. In these texts, they don't quote biblical verses to say, this is what God is planning in 40 days beforehand and all of that. We don't have a text that describes God doing this. We do have, in the Torah, stories in which it looks like God is positioned as a matchmaker. Right? Can you give me an example? Well, yeah, that's kind of cheating, though. Right? You're right. Adam and Eve. Jacob and Rachel, how?
Well, just that, you know, she goes to the well, and he's there.
It just happens to work out that she's at the well when he shows up. Or go back a generation earlier, right? Isaac and Rebekah. Eliezer comes to the well and he says, God, help me out here with this mission of mine. So he gives God a test, right? He says, if she comes down to the well and she offers water for me and for my camels, then I'll know this is the one. Which isn't his job. His job is find a girl from the family. Not find a nice girl who gives water to camels. But that's the test he gives to God, and sure enough, that's exactly what happens. It's matchmaking, right? It's all set up. In general, that's your best idea biblically is if you're a young, eligible male, or not necessarily even young, but if you're an eligible male, you go to the well. Generally speaking, that's where you'll find her. Moses did the same thing. Yeah?
I heard the well, all the wells in the Bible, and me, was the biblical Starbucks.
Well, I don't think I said that, but if I did, I would be proud. It's a good way to look at it. Starbucks, Tim Hortons, second cup, whatever you like. But it is. That's where they meet. But what's the logic of this being part of God's job description? Why? What's the logic behind Bashert?
I think when I think of it, I relate it to other things that are like what we say destined to be.
Yeah.
Like it could be your career you choose, and if you're happy with it, I mean, mm-hmm. It could be other things. It's not just marriage. Marriage
right.
is the topic we're looking at now, but
right. I think it's
a lot of things. But the reverse side of it is we have free will, right? And we could choose to drop that. Like there are people, for example, that just change their career midlife. And some are successful and some are not successful.
Right.
So it's a lot of free will has to do with the result of the matchmaking.
Right. So in terms of your first point, that would point to number 8 again, which didn't just say the most famous line, so-and-so is going to marry so-and-so, but it also talked about the house. It also talked about the field. In other words, this could be looked at as just part of divine manipulation in general. God's really busy making sure that you're going to live here, and you're going to have this career, and you're going to have this spouse, and it's all set. So you could look at it as just, you know, general sort of, you know, not to use a nice word, but general manipulation. Right? You could legitimately say that. However, I think there is something else going on that's marriage specific. If we go back to the splitting of Adam and Eve and the two stories, and I pointed out briefly that Nachmanides believes, based on the Talmud, that actually they're created as two souls in one body, and then they're split off from each other. Well, then it makes sense that they're two parts of one soul. It is arranged that they should be the ones who will reunite. It fits with the idea of the two souls that have to be brought back together again. But stronger than that, we said last week that the very first thing God says he's interested in is, or God, she's interested in, whatever you like, is procreation. Right? That's the very first thing that God is interested in. Well, if that's priority one, it makes sense that God is going to make sure that people are matched up with somebody that they could have children with. Right? If that's really the most important thing on the planet for God, then he's going to have to spend time on it. So that's the that would be, to me, the logic. But now we have to come back to the problems. What in the world do we do with this? And the most basic problem is the one that's already been stated, which is free will. Right? What in the world do you do about the fact that people do have free will, and it's a very basic concept within Judaism, not to mention the fact that it doesn't always work out. Right? It doesn't always work out. What's the standard quoted divorce rate is 50-something percent. That means the odds are against people. That's what it means.
That's because we're flawed. You may find you're shared and you've got the one. But if he or she decides to cheat on you or whatever, you're not going to stay together because we're wrong.
Right. So one way to look at it is, as Betty is suggesting, that it's also possible to mess it up. Having your bashert doesn't mean you're going to keep your bashert. And that would be one way to look at it. But take a look at Maimonides in source number 10. Maimonides wrote a commentary to Pirkei Avot. It's really an introduction. He wrote a commentary and an introduction. The introduction to Pirkei Avot is called Shmona Prakim, 8 chapters. And this is from the last chapter of his 8 chapters. He says, many times people will err and think that some of a person's free will acts are actually forced upon him, like whom he will marry, or what kind of money he'll have. This is not true. The woman who marries with ketubah and kiddushin, ketubah being, you're familiar with the marriage document, we're familiar with, but it's more than that. We'll talk about the ketubah when we talk about marriage. Kiddushin is the first stage of the marriage. It's when the man gives the woman the ring. That's kiddushin. So he says, the woman he marries with ketubah and kiddushin is appropriate for him, and he takes her, and they have children, and reproduction is a mitzvah. God will not make decrees compelling performance of a mitzvah. In the same way that God doesn't force me to blow shofar, to put on tefillin, to give tzedakah, God doesn't force me to marry so-and-so. Maimonides is directly counter to what we saw in sources number 8 and 9. He does not believe that it's set up and that you're just going to marry the person who's for you and it's all planned. He says God doesn't coerce mitzvot. Yes?
Perhaps the concept of arrangement could be acceptable, but God does not interfere how that is evolved. So it could be the shared that boy A and girl B meet, and it could be right, but who they are and how they deal with their lives and their relationships is not a decree that. That's the free will part. It's ordained that they all our lives are ordained by the Almighty, and therefore, but how we engage in that is not step by step.
Right. And that, to me, that's the most appealing way to look at it. This is an opportunity. But we blow opportunities all the time. If you take a look at source number 13, I'm going to come back to 11 and 12. But number 13 states it. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who was a very interesting figure in 18th century Germany, really somebody worth knowing more about, very controversial. But he wrote a commentary to Maimonides' Introduction to Pirkei Avot that we just read. And he says the following. He says, this is not a problem. Don't worry about Maimonides saying it's all free will when the Talmud says that it's all preordained. For God will decree that if so-and-so wishes to perform the mitzvah of marrying, and he will make the efforts to fulfill it, God will make available to him a woman who is fitting for him. In other words, you try, and God is going to try to help you. But at the end of the day, it's your call. It may work. It may not work. You try it. And whether that's because you don't initially choose the right person, or whether it's because they get married and then it doesn't work out because they can't make it work, that happens. The idea that the Talmud is trying to get across is either the two souls matching up idea, or the idea simply of this is so important to God that God makes sure there is somebody. But, you know, it's your call in terms of whether it's going to play out and how it's going to play out. And just as a support for this, sources 11 and 12, bless you. Maimonides supports his position in a letter by quoting source number 11. Source number 11 is talking about an army situation. The rule is that when the Jews are set to go out to certain wars, there's a big announcement made to the army that certain people should go home. And one of the announcements is this one in number 11. And who is it who has betrothed a woman and not wed her if they engaged in what's called kiddushin, the first stage of the marriage, but they haven't actually consummated the marriage? They haven't completed the marriage yet. They didn't have the blessings under the chuppah, etc. So who is it who has not completed the marriage? Let him return home, lest he die in war and another man wed her. So Maimonides says, if you believe that it's all foreordained, you're going to end up with so-and-so, then this shouldn't be a concern. Now, you could answer Maimonides. There are ways to answer that. But his point is that he does not believe that it's all set. And in source number 12, I bring you another source to support that. And again, you could argue with this source too, but it's worth knowing. The Talmud states, we have a general principle. We don't do marriages on certain days because ein ma'arvin simcha b'simcha. You don't blend together two happy occasions lest one overshadow the other. So, yeah, for example, in the event that a couple has twin baby boys, we don't do the brit one right after the other. You do the brit for one, you pause, have a speech, eat something, whatever it is, and then you do the brit for the second one. Let each one have their own day. This was a very big issue in terms of weddings historically, because communities had a situation where there were women who were orphans or came from families that couldn't afford the wedding, and more wealthy families would say, well, I'm marrying off my child, and we'll have their wedding the same day, and they'll be able to use the same feast, and that way they'll be covered. It was a beautiful practice, but the concern is you want each couple to have their own celebration. So they had to be careful about that, to give each one its own space, in order that each one have its own celebration. And the same thing is true when it comes to getting married on holidays. You're not allowed to get married on Yom Tov. However, take a look at 12, Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days, the middle days of the holiday, which don't have the same status, the same full status as the first day and the last day. So you could betroth a woman on Chol HaMoed, even though they are part of the holiday. Why? Lest someone else precede him with prayer. Meaning, somebody could pray to God, and God could help them, and then, in other words, they want to marry this person instead of you marrying them, and there's a possibility that they're going to get in with their prayers to God, and they'll end up marrying her instead. So therefore, you're allowed to betroth on Chol HaMoed, lest you end up being the victim of somebody else jumping the line. The upshot of all of this is that, number one, Jewish dating is meant to fit our image of love. I'm sorry, of love. Our image of, well, love the gadol. Love as a general term, but really the needs we outlined. The material needs and the spiritual needs. Procreation and growth as an ethical, spiritual person. We also desire to have ahava she'eina tluya b'davar, this love that is not dependent on externalities. But you recognize that that's something that develops over time. And so what the couple is supposed to do is to try to find those other needs, and hopefully they will find this love as well, but it may not be in the initial stage. It may be something that evolves. Now, I would love to spend more time on the dating thing. I have a whole bunch of other material that I wanted to do. Like, the Talmud has advice, like what you're supposed to look for and things like that. But we're supposed to be discussing marriage also. Yeah, sometimes when I do a series, so I'm comfortable skipping a topic. But there are no topics here to skip. And we only have the 4 weeks, because the following Wednesday is Shavuot. So it's not like we have the option of adding a week. So what that means is we're going to move on to marriage. Excuse me. So I begin the discussion of marriage. Maybe I'll do a new recording for that.